welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amadei, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. I also host other podcasts and shows such as The Michael Amadei Show, Inside Show Business, and World Poetry Open Mic. My new mission is to create new worlds of fiction through podcasts with my company, Creature and Ghost. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs and The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics. He's the founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is the creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. He is also the host of Dante's Old South on NPR. Our guest today is Adam Shmeens Smirnoff. Adam Smirnoff is the guitarist and the co-founder of the Grammy-nominated funk powerhouse called Lettuce, which began in 1992 when all of its members attended a music program at Berklee College of Music in Boston as teenagers. Now, 30 years later, the band have played countless shows to large international audiences and have produced 8 studio albums, including their newest, Unify, which drops on June 6, 2022. Smirnoff has also shared the stage with a myriad of other artists, including Lady Gaga, Robert Randolph and the family band Redman, Chaka Khan, John Scofield, the Clark Sisters, Mikayo Parker, Dr. John, and members of the Meters and the Wu-Tang Clan, as long as many others. In this episode, Adam shares stories from his career and teaches us something valuable about relationships in the creative pursuit. So without any further ado, here is our interview with Adam Shmeens Smirnoff.
Tonight on This Business of Music and Poetry, we have a man whom the gods bestowed a gift and we love as the lead guitarist of the band Lettuce. Adam Shmeens Smirnoff, how are you, boss?
I'm doing great, man. Thank you. Thank you for having me on here. And, I'm not just a lead guitar player. I'm a rhythm guitar player, which is most of the job for Lettuce. And that's what I love to do. I love to play rhythm guitar. There it is.
Rhythm guitar, at the altar I stand. And it's an honor to have you here. I've been a fan for years, and we brought on, I want to mention now, a co-host, Andy Whitehorn, who's the music editor of the Blue Mountain Review. He'll be jumping on a little bit later with some questions, but I always like to start at the beginning, a little bit like David Copperfield. And in 1992 at Berklee, you were a teenager. You met another Adam at Berklee, and you started Lettuce. Give us some of that background and how that went down, how that magic came to happen.
Yeah, I wrote about this the other day. The full story would be for my, and here's the thing. Everyone in this band who was there at that time is going to have their own version of this story. What I say is not, like, it's not the story, it's my story of how I became part of this, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were to talk to Adam Deitch, you were to talk to Jesus Coombs, you were to talk to Ryan Zoidis, you're going to get all different stories here. So for me, I grew up in New York. My family moved up to Westchester County in Hastings on Hudson. And I wasn't really finding the musical connections that I needed to make with people in that town. My parents made the suggestion, why don't I go to this Berklee School of Music 5-week program to expand my horizons and to see if this is something that I'd want to do professionally, maybe. There's a lot of other musicians in my family, and they were always very supportive of me studying music and, getting lessons and helping out with instruments and of stuff of that nature. I was already playing in the jazz band at that time in my school. I had a very cool teacher, Kenneth Jernigan, who kind of saw in me something that I didn't see, which was that, and he came to me one day with a cassette mixtape, and it had Tower of Power on it. It had James Brown on it. And I said, why are you giving this to me? And he said, because every time I see, every time we start playing something funky in the jazz band, I see you light up. So he gave me this tape, and it led me into all these different explorations of funk music. And at that time, I was also extremely into the album Maceo Parker, Life on Planet Groove. And of course, we had been playing Herbie Hancock stuff as well. So that leads into this. I was also very into Jimi Hendrix at the time. And so here we go. I am heading to Boston. I'm going to stay in a college dormitory for the first time in my life. Now, I thought this was a music camp. I didn't really understand before I'd left, before I'd gotten there, that this was essentially a college program where there were no counselors. You were on your own. There were essentially, like, 1992, there were like not really many rules. And I didn't understand that this structure, this freedom that they were giving all of these kids was going to be what it was. I was also dealing at the time, I have alopecia universalis, where I had lost all my hair, and I was dealing with it. I was probably only about like 3 years into having it at that time, and I was uncomfortable. I'm very comfortable with it now. But then when I was a kid, I was wearing a wig at that time. So my parents had me get my own room, a single in a dormitory, which was very rare for the kids at Berklee School of Music. I was also an avid THC user already by that age. And I remember being like, oh shit, what am I going to do in fucking Boston? I don't know anyone in Boston. So I had been stealing weed from my parents at that time. And, so I go to their like special spot, and I find, like, oh my God, this is the most amount of weed I've ever seen them have. The gods had bestowed upon me like the ultimate fucking stash. I can curse on this show, right?
Yes, okay, please.
this is the unfiltered version.
This is the best interview ever, bro. Keep going.
So I must take like a half ounce from my mom. And so we get up there, sign up for the classes. My parents leave. And I'm sitting now in my single dormitory room, staring at the walls. So I'm like, shit, what do I do? So I take the ounce of weed, the half ounce of weed, whatever. And I don't know, this is like some shit I did as a kid, some stupid shit. I rolled everything into little pinner joints. So I was wasting time, essentially. And I put it all in the drawer of my desk. And then that was done. So then I start staring at my guitar equipment, the amp I have and whatnot. And I go, well, I guess I'm here for music. And they're on the 7th floor of the 150 building on Mass Ave. They had practice rooms at the end of the hallway. They were split into two. On one side were drum practice rooms, and on the other side were instrument practice rooms.
Right.
So I drag my stuff down the hallway, and I put it in the room, and I just start to play guitar, which was something that I did at that age a lot to kind of like help me deal with a lot of the emotional stuff that I was going through. You know, kind of being teased by other kids, feeling different. and not feeling like myself in some ways. Music was and has always been a real savior for me. So I'm playing. I don't remember what I was playing, anything like that. It was so long ago. But all of a sudden, there's this knock on my door. I was a little surprised. Who's practice room door? I open it up, and there's this young man there. I remember he had his hat on backwards. He looked kind of cool, right? He goes, "Hey, I'm sorry. I couldn't help but overhearing you play. I was wondering if you'd want to drag your guitar equipment into my drum practice room. I'm playing right over there." And so I'm like, man, that sounds great. That's why I'm here, right?
Yep.
I came here to make those connections with other musicians that I don't really have in my town. So I pull my stuff into that room, and this guy blows my mind. What a musician, what a drummer. And it turns out to be Adam Deitch, the very first night of that 5-week program, 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago. I guess when we would get to like June or something like that, it'll be exactly 30 years. And I remember us, we played Fire by Jimi Hendrix. I sang the whole thing. We improvised together. And you know, a lot of guitar players are very concerned with like who can play fast, and Deitch was never concerned with that. He was like, "Wow, you have pocket. You like to groove. You're a rhythm guitar player at heart." And I think that's really where our connection was made, you know. So that was night one. And then after we play, we start talking with each other. And it's like, "Where are you from?" "Oh, I'm from New York." And he's like, "Oh, I'm from New York."
Nice.
And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm from Hastings." He's like, "I'm from Nyack." I'm like, "Oh, my family's been going to Nyack to see family friends for as long as I can remember. I've been to your town a million times. You're only like 20 minutes from me." And he's like, "Cool. Where are you on this floor?" "Yeah, I'm on this floor. We're both on the 7th floor. Where's your dorm room?" So I show him where my dorm room is. And he's like, "How'd you get a single dorm room?" At that point, I got nervous because I'm wearing a wig and I don't want anyone to know, right? And he probably knew anyway. It was probably obvious to him. And so I get nervous and I change the subject immediately and I open up the drawer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Hey, you don't happen to..." And he's like, "Oh my God, look at all this." Right, so, you know. And then we do that. And this guy ends up becoming my best friend for the past 30 years, best man at my wedding, and someone who I've share many, many, many joys in life with, whether it be basketball, ping pong, music, friendship, life, family. And, you know, I'm obviously our families got very close too. And, you know, it's been a very great and productive relationship in my life. And that moment, you know, I don't think things would be the same for me without that moment. Things would have gone a different way, you know?
I do. And there've been so many, like the alchemy, that I always try to bring out and ask. And it's a mix of the natural talent that we are born with and then the technical training and that we do to kind of hone that skill. In your opinion, what is your balance between what you're gifted with and the work it takes to make it on stage?
I have no idea. I mean, I know that there's 10 million people more talented than me out there. And I just feel really lucky to be able to do what I do and to play with the guys in my band who are some of the most talented people I've ever met in my entire life, and always like surprise you again and remind you when you get to be with them and hang out with them exactly how special and talented they are, in so many different ways, multi-instrumentalists, songwriters, producers, beat makers. It's just, these are the people that have influenced me continually in my life to improve myself, not just only as a musician, but as a human being.
You found Adam Deitch. You found him early on. Deitch, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah.
You found Deitch early on and you start playing together. As more people joined the band and found you guys and you decided to go it together, how did your sound change, or was it just more defined?
Well, there was no sound to be changed at that time. I mean, it was just kind of 16-year-old kids who were trying to figure it all out. There was no plan, you know, or anything like that. So as I said, everyone's story is going to be different. Everyone met in a different way, whether it be via they were in an ensemble together, they were in a class together, and or this was the other guy who had weed, or, you know, whatever it may have been. And I just remember we all got an ensemble room one day, and we all got in that ensemble room, and it was kind of like, well, what do we know how to play together? And so the beginnings of the band were exactly what I was referencing to before, that we played songs from Life on Planet Roof. We played Southwick, which is also known as Shake Everything You Got, Maceo Parker tune. We played Chameleon, Herbie Hancock, together, which was really fun. We referenced that in our last gig in Portland, Maine. I don't remember the last time that we did that. It was so funny to me to be like, wow, this was the first thing we ever played together, guys. And, you know, so yeah, I feel like obviously there's been a lot of change because we change. We change as musicians. We grow as musicians. We grow as people. We grew as a group. And I don't think many of us thought about like the business aspect of Lettuce at all during this time. We were just kids, mm-hmm. you know, we just were trying to grow and play with each other and have fun.
I think one of the things that has been, really eye-opening as we've done the course of these interviews and you know, this podcast over time is talking to people who are musicians who have spent a long time doing this as you and your band have, is that it is truly, the business is a necessity, but it's not the focus, right? The love of the music, the love of the relationships in the band and with the audience, the evolution of people seems to really be the focus. And I can kind of sense that from what you're saying as well. So at what point did you start feeling like you had to start paying attention to the business, if that makes sense? You know, like you get gigs and you get paid and, you know.
It wasn't until much later, because okay. after that program was done, we all went our separate ways. And because Adam lived so close to me, I was able to, you know, take trips to Nyack and hang out with him and, you know, become closer friends at that time. I would say some of the guys in the group, being born from professional musician families where their mom and dads are musicians, like Jesus's dad is a professional musician and his brother's a professional musician, and Deitch's parents, and some of these guys would tell you, like Nigel, his father, some of these guys would tell you, like, I've always known I'm supposed to be a professional musician. For me, I didn't have that. I wasn't sure. I definitely lacked confidence in myself at that time. You know, obviously being an artist is like this weird dichotomy of like, you know, look at me on stage, I'm good at what I do, go home, I'm awful, I'm terrible, I need to work on myself. It's the only way to improve. And it's this weird balance that goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And my life has contained a lot of that balance and imbalance and just trying to, you know, get better. And I don't think at first when I graduated high school that I knew that this life was going to happen for me personally. I ended up going to a different college. And I remember I went to Ithaca College. I think I graduated a year before some of the guys. And just because of when I was born, my age, and I remember being there and feeling very uncomfortable at Ithaca. And I remember one night I took some white blotter LSD during that time, 1993 I think it was before it turned 94. And I literally dropped out of Ithaca the next day, the very next day. I was like, yo. And I remember calling Adam and him being like, well, look, I'm going to go to Berkeley next year. Why don't you transfer to Berkeley? So I went home. I started the transfer process. I had to get a job for what would have been my second semester of college. And then I end up going to Berkeley before the guys get there, the summer program, which was like the 12-week program, the full college semester. And that's where I started doing my first professional gigs. And then when the other guys got there, that, you know, regular first semester, we were like, oh my God, you know, because it was a different kind of communication back then. There was no internet. There was no like, let me text this guy and see if he's going to go. You know, I had lost touch with, you know, a lot of the guys in Lettuce during that time. It's not like I was speaking to them on a regular basis. And so when it's like all of a sudden we're all in a dormitory, and it's like, wait a sec, you're back and you're back and you're back. Holy cow. Mm-hmm. We have to jam mm-hmm. again. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. we start doing that. And I think the business kind of came to us in a weird kind of way. Cause I had a friend who in the Boston area was going to Tufts University and was living at a place called the Wilson House in Tufts. And he started throwing these like psychedelic parties that were kind of like mushroom LSD parties. You know, we were experimental kids back then.
As were we. You with family.
Yeah. And I'm comfortable talking about this now. So
good.
I think before we might have been kind of like withheld with truly telling these stories.
Yeah.
But I'm cool with that. And I hope you guys don't judge me for it. But
dude, no. We have a whole conversation to have, man.
I'm talking to the audience. Listen. I hope you guys don't judge me for this.
Oh, right. God, no, dude.
So we start playing. We didn't even have a band name. And I remember some of the guys, we were like, oh man, I don't have a bass amp here. Or, so we would ask other people in like the dormitory, hey man, would you let us borrow your bass amp? And then we started playing these parties, still didn't have a name. And one of our friends, I remember, suggested to us, because we had also gone to some of these other house parties at the time. They weren't like professional people's gigs. We would never go to someone's gig and be like, hey man, would you let us play?
Yeah.
But like at these parties in the ensemble rooms, like, hey man, like, during your break, would you let us get up and play a couple tunes? Uh-huh. Like, so would you let us borrow your bass amp? Would you let us, you know, use your drums? Like,
lettuce.
And then my friend kind of suggested, why don't you just call it Lettuce? And we thought it was kind of good at the time, but it kind of stuck. And I just remember, like, as I said, communication was a different point
right
out there. And this one event really stands out in my mind where, I don't know if you guys have ever been to Boston. There's Newberry Street right there. People used to hang out at the top of Newberry Street, whether it was like bike couriers at the time, just kids, people who did drugs. Uh-huh. And I remember walking down that street and someone was handing out flyers. And I was given this flyer and it said, have you seen this band, Lettuce? Could you contact us? Like, they wanted to give us a gig and there was no way of getting in touch with us. That blew my mind. I was like, what? Someone for Lettuce. And, you know, during these times, there were different configurations of Lettuce. There were different people in and out, us experimenting with having singers and rappers and, you know, throughout this whole time of just trying to figure out who we were. Again, I don't think any of us at the time really thought this is what we were going to do with our lives. We were Berklee College of Music kids. What we wanted to do was get out there, get signed to a major label, play with major artists. You know, these were the goals back then. And as I said, goals change, people change. So we started doing more and more, and then an event happened. Eric Krasno and Ryan Zoidis were in Kraz's dorm room. And I think Kraz was given a whole bunch of weed, of trees, of ganja. And I remember it being, I remember seeing it and being like, whoa, that's a lot. And it was untrimmed at the time, so it looked really big and bushy. Mm-hmm. And their roommate, specifically Kraz's roommate, freaked out and told the RD of the dormitories, and like security came and they got kicked out of the dorms. And it was kind of a big deal because I know they were both really freaked out by the whole situation. And Zoidis, for a while, even though he wasn't allowed to come back to the dorms, would literally come and like hide in Deitch and my dorm room in the mm-hmm. closet where I had like a 4-foot bomb. And Kraz, he was like, that's it, I'm done, I'm leaving the school. And he went up to Northampton and went to Hampshire College at that time.
Gotcha.
So then it started being like, hey, he found us a gig at the Iron Horse in Northampton. We're going to play the Red Barn at Northampton College. And when we started going up there, now more kind of like ways of recording yourself at home were more available. 4-tracks, tapes. And Kraz during this time really took the helm of like, we're going to record and we're going to call ourselves Lettuce and we're going to put out tapes. And I have some of those beginning tapes here. Lettuce Live, which is mostly at the Red Barn. And he had met up there at the time, like Al and Neil Evans, which eventually became Soul Live. those guys were in a band called Moon Boot Lover with a singer named Peter Prince. And Peter Prince is on these tapes, and we're doing a cover of the of an Average White Band tune, Person to Person. We do Sly by Herbie Hancock. I remember the first tune that we recorded was Reunion, because we were getting back together again. And it seemed like a repeating theme in our lives. Like, we were the 5 week kid. We came back as freshmen. We had that reunion. This event happened. We still got back together. It was another reunion. And we recorded that song on a four track. It was the drums from God Made Me Funky by Mike Clark on the demo. It wasn't even Deitch playing drums. I believe Kraz played bass on that recording. And we recorded Reunion. And then I think business started to move a little bit more forward, because then we had tapes. We could get some more gigs. We could play the Iron Horse more. Again, trying to figure out like what configurations were what. Soul Live obviously ended up becoming, you know, Kraz's main focus at that time. Adam Deitch got the Average White Band gig, which was interesting after playing Person to Person with each other.
Right.
Jesus stayed and finished school. I was playing Wally's. There were a lot of us who played Wally's Cafe in Boston consistently. And I had a group called The Squad, which contained Charles Haynes and Mark Kelly, who is the bass player for The Roots.
Yeah.
Sam Kininger, Jeff Basker, who's one of the, you know, biggest producers and songwriters in the world today. He won Producer of the Year. And he was the keyboard player during this next era after Michael Butler, who was the keyboard player during all the times that we were doing the parties. And it wasn't even like people got kicked out or anything like that. It was kind of like, hey, we have this gig. Are you available to do it? And he might be like, no, I have work scheduled for that time. I can't get out of it. And so, you know, it wasn't really like this tightly formed thing yet. And I remember specifically one summer, we got this residency in New York at a club called The Wetlands back then, where we were going to play weekly for a month. And not everyone could even make all these gigs. I don't even believe Jesus, because Jesus lived in California. He lived in Los Angeles. How is he going to get to New York? It's not like we had a budget or anything like that to fly people. So this guy named Matt Rabano played bass on that. We had who became very big. He played on Lauryn Hill's first record. He was the bass player, or still is the bass player, in Taking Back Sunday. Right. Like, you know, all of these people ended up being huge professionals in the world. And so I remember on that, like, we had John Scofield on one of those gigs. We had Fred Wesley on one of those gigs. And some of these recordings, because The Wetlands was like home of the taper, have actually come about in like archives, and people have sent recently to us some of these gigs that we've done. And, you know, I think our memories at this point are kind of like all a little different of how everything transpired. And there's reminders of like, yeah, you weren't on that gig. No. Oh, I totally forgot. What was Jacques Schwartzbart doing on that gig? He ended up becoming like being in D'Angelo's band for the Soultronics tour you know, one of the most biggest influential tours of our lifetime. And from that Wetlands gig, Deitch ends up getting the John Scofield gig, right? As I said, a lot of us weren't chasing like that this was going to be our main focus at that time, like going out with Scofield, going out with Average White Band. Eventually, I got the Robert Randolph gig and did like 5 or 6 years with Robert out on the road. I once did the Lady Gaga gig for her first Monster Ball tour.
Nice.
And all these, of course, are like incredible learning experiences and musical experiences for all of us. Soul Live was huge. The Zoidus and the Horns were out with them. Nigel was out with them, you know, and Jesus was in LA literally playing on like Britney Spears and Dr. Dre, working with Dr. Dre and playing on all these incredible, gigantic, huge platinum selling albums. You know what I mean? Like the way things ended up turning out was just kind of like really lucky and unexpected in some ways.
I think luck has such a big part to play in this. I think one thing that we have is, you know, a lot of the people who listen to our podcast here are, you know, musicians or are poets or creative people who are trying to build some career off of it. And we always want to ask people, you know, from in your type of position, if you could give them a piece of advice, something of encouragement or otherwise, what would you tell them?
I would tell them to not give up. I would tell them to keep going. That you're going to run into roadblocks. You're going to run into frustration. But the joy of the music itself that you have and the personal relationships and the musical relationships, try and rely on those to get through everything and be a good person. Be a trustworthy human. It's all we have, you know. Be nice to people as much as you can, you know. The other advice is surpass us. We're in the world of the internet now. You can literally, in one post, surpass what we did for 20 years of getting in vans and sleeping on the floors and, you know, and all of a sudden wake up tomorrow with, you know, 1.5 million followers and say that you're doing a gig somewhere and sell out immediately. You know what I mean? Just go right by it. Mm-hmm. That would be my other advice to people nowadays. And you know, when I'm talking about people doing things on their own, Ryan Zoidis' band, Rustic Overtones, at the time, got signed to a gigantic major label, recorded an album with David Bowie, producing a record. Yeah, I'm just saying that, like, people were doing, like, big, huge things in their lives without lettuce being the main focus. However, we still somehow managed to record our first record out of here after that Wetlands kind of thing, where we were like, oh man, the two guests, Fred Wesley and John Scofield, can be on our record and in some way give us some notoriety. Neil Evans from Soul Eyes guested on that record, who would then eventually become Lettuce's full-time keyboard player sometime after that. And that record led into being released in Japan and led into Lettuce having a pretty big Japanese following, big enough that we were invited to play the Blue Note out there. And it was a double bill with Michelle Indignacello and Lettuce where we would, I think, switch who finished the night. I think Lettuce closed the night sometimes because they just didn't want to be up that late or something like that. I don't remember the exact details. I could be wrong here. But, you know, one of the interesting parts about that particular thing is that our friend Jason Pinsky ends up coming out, bringing his friend, bringing this new thing, this Pro Tools Digio 2 that had come out, right? And you were available to record digitally now. And I don't even think they really knew how to use it that well, but luckily the guys at the Blue Note, I remember them being like, hey, can you hook this up for us? And the guys at the Blue Note did it. And so, all right, so there's some fun parts to this story. Number one, the drummer, Chris Dave, very famous, huge drummer, Mint Condition, I believe, was his first band, was supposed to go out to Tokyo with Michelle. And then last minute, he cancels. Mm-hmm. And so then Michelle last minute asks Adam to do double duty on drums, play with Lettuce and her. And I remember that being a very nerve-wracking experience for Adam. Michelle is, you know, one of our idols and such an incredible musician and such a visionary. And, you know, obviously learning all that material was a lot while dealing with the time zone change, the flights, and everything else like going into the gig. The other thing too was we had always wanted to have a trumpet in our section, our horn section at that time. And I had just done a gig with Rashawn Ross. And I remember hearing that there was an extra plane ticket because Chris Dave wasn't going. So I remember asking Rashawn, hey man, why don't you just come to our rehearsal with us? So he comes to the rehearsal, and of course everyone hears Rashawn, who's just a master of his instrument. And they're all like, oh my God, do you want to come with us? It just totally worked.
Yeah, out. Man.
Exactly what I was like hoping would happen.
Right.
And, you know, so Rashawn ends up coming. He doesn't have an artist visa at the time. He just goes on a regular visa. And when we get to the Blue Note, they were not happy about that. They were, look, we've been bringing musicians over here forever. Like, you're not going to get our club in trouble. So they said, here's what has to happen. You guys can play 3 songs of each of your set, because we were doing 2 sets a night. It would be like us, Michelle, Michelle, us. I believe that's how it went. And we played there for 5 nights. So there were like 10 sets in total. And all of them, I remember being recorded. And they said, after you play for 3 songs, you can say, hey, our friend is in the audience and we're going to invite him up to play. So after 3 songs of every set, Rashawn would come up and play the last of the set with us. And of course, when you listen to Live in Tokyo, it seems like it's like one set, which is not the case at all. It's kind of like highlight moments from each of those sets that I believe Jesus and Ari Raskin, the engineer who did Out of Here, sat through for hours. Like going through this stuff and really picking like the real highlight moments, which is like looking back, what an incredible job they did doing. You listen to that record and you're like, wow, man, there are some really magical moments from this. And you also have to remember, we were we were so tired. I remember all of us literally being asleep on the floor right before it's like time to go on from the jet lag of being in Japan. So there you go. We end up recording out of here. We end up recording live in Tokyo. And we all go our separate ways again and do all the things that I've been talking about that, that each member of the band is doing. Now, you know, we get to the point where we're going to record the Rage record. And I remember that was like when we brought Nigel into the fold. And, you know, specifically, I remember going with Nigel to a studio in Nyack, or Rockland County, excuse me, with Chris Pinsett, Cinemax, one of Deitch's longtime friends, and recording with Redman there. He was hanging out. making my way back home. And this wasn't like the demo the rough take of that song we recorded at the studio for Rage. And I kind of like was like, Nigel, let's try and do something with this. And then I brought it back to the guys and been like, guys, check this out. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh wow, Nigel's in the fold now with us. And you know, again, this is how the things are working. And that album gets done. And, you know, now we're starting to get to the point of like, man, I'm out on the road with Robert a lot. And I go to somewhere in the middle of the country because Lettuce was pretty much performing pretty much exclusively at that time, either New York or Boston. And that's about it. Those were our markets, you know? But now I'm starting to get around, I'm touring the country, you know, and people are coming up to me out of the blue and being like, man, we are the biggest Lettuce fans. You guys have to come out here. Yeah. And I did, existed, you know, that people were like, live in Tokyo to me is one of the most influential albums to me that I've heard, and it's changed like how I want to be with my band. And so I feel like Live in Tokyo ended up getting this gigantic underground following, and I just kept hearing the same message over and over and over again, and I started to get really inspired. Being out on the road with Robert, I started asking a lot of business questions, like, you know, how much does this bus cost per week? I wonder what kind of guarantee. I started making guesses of what kind of guarantees people were getting, and kind of being like, man, I think if we tried this with Lettuce, we can maybe do this. And I don't think that anyone really, you know, had accepted, including myself, that idea that it could be done, that we could make a living from it, that we could be a full-time band. You know, this was always kind of like a side project. And, you know, we met resistance along the way from different people, and we kind of like had to figure it out how this could get done, which kind of like led us to the lineup that we have today. And how we're doing things now, obviously it worked.
Yeah, man.
We did get out on the bus. We did find out that we had a national/international audience, and we're still finding that out now. You know, when we're doing our Europe tours now, we're finding out that this music has really spread, not just you know, from Boston to New York to all over the world. And that's, you know, where we're at today, trying to use all the methods that we have available via social media, the internet, to try and, you know, reach the world and to continue to grow our audience, and, you know, aside from grow ourselves musically and continue this path that we've been on.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us, and we want to thank Adam Schmeens Smirnoff for an incredible conversation. You can find Adam at lettucefunk.com or on his various social media profiles. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at mikelamide.com, worldpoetrymagazine.com, and at worldpoetryopenmic.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart, for it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.